Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are and what time of the day you're listening to this episode of Talking the Blues. I'm not going to do a DJ type thing, but the podcast started with Start Me Up, which I think is appropriate given that Carlo on Thursday, or was it Friday? I think it was possibly Friday, said that we've got a 12-game season and, you know, everything that we will achieve or not achieve is down to the next 12 games. Good morning or good afternoon to both Andy and George.
Good day.
Hi, Paul.
Hi. So, exciting times.
Very much so.
Very, yeah.
Yeah. It seems, I know you can be bipolar as a football supporter, but our mood swings from the Fulham game to where we are now. When, you know, the Fulham game, we were almost in despair by...
No, we were in despair.
Yeah, okay, we were in despair. To one of sort of, I suppose, elation in one sense, but also a quiet confidence that in the last few weeks we've seen from Carlo an ability to get things done that we've not seen at Everton for an awful long time.
Mm. Yep. And it's the calm manner in which he goes about his work, which is really interesting. He never seems to get aerated or flustered or overexcited. I mean, there's a saying in sport, isn't there? You don't get too high on a win and you don't get too low on a loss. You know, it's all about maintaining a balance and equilibrium and
failed that test.
Pardon?
I said I failed that test plenty of times.
Well, this is the thing. We're all failing that test. We all get overexcited at a win and we all get manically depressive at a loss. But as long as Carlo is happy to stand on the touchline and sip his tea as the fifth goal in a nine-goal, the winner in a nine-goal thriller goes in, then that'll do for me, I guess.
It's original, isn't it?
Well, you can't. I mean, you think about it. You look at other managers, you know, winning a game like that. You know, Mourinho would have been off down the touchline. Alex Ferguson's been on the running up and down the pitch a few times. You know, Klopp would have done three or four laps of Anfield had that been, you know, Liverpool winning 5-4 in extra time. And yet Carlo, you know, afterwards, you know, well, I was cold. I was having a cup of tea. It's brilliant. And everyone else is going potty, and he's sipping a cup of tea.
the point is, though, he's seen it. Sorry, George. He's seen it all before.
Yeah.
He's seen it as a player, and he's obviously seen it as a manager in many different clubs. And there's probably not a scenario in football that he's not come across previously. And I think it's part of his nature. And you know, obviously in the book that he wrote, which is called Quiet Leadership, it's a, you know, it is part of his, of what he is as a person. He's not a big reactor in that sense.
Yeah, he's not given to histrionics, is he?
Doesn't appear to be. And I've never read anywhere that he's ever torn a strip off somebody, although I suspect he's got extremely high standards and extremely high expectations of people.
He strikes me as one of those managers who could give you a look that could kill.
But you wouldn't want to disappoint him, would you?
Pardon?
You wouldn't want to disappoint him.
No, exactly. And you know, I think that he could probably give you, you'd probably get a look of disappointment from him first. And then if you really nosed up, then I would think he probably would give you a stare as though to say, me and you need to have a sit down, young man, and straighten you out. But thankfully, you know, they're responding to the looks of disappointment rather than it going to the full blown raised eyebrow stare. however he's going about it, he's doing it very, very calmly and measuredly. I think that's one of the things I'm enjoying. He doesn't appear to get worked up about anything.
He got worked up last year when he got sent off, remember?
Yeah, but he didn't exactly throw his toys out of the pram pole. I mean, he was disappointed at a decision and queried it and got a red card. But, you know, imagine if that had been the boot on the other foot, you know, and it had been, imagine Ferguson, if he'd have gone on the pitch and queried a decision and got a red card, he'd have gone loopy.
Yeah, but obviously a very, very, very different character.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I was thinking about it last night. And I think when Carlo first came, he sort of took his time to evaluate what he had.
Yeah.
It's only in recent months that we're actually seeing him sort of fully operate. If you understand what I'm saying. I was listening to the rugby union coach, you know, Eddie Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really interesting about, because, you know, he's coached like dozens of different clubs, and including obviously several international sides. And he said that, you know, when he goes into a new situation, he sits back and he evaluates, and he looks around the room, and what he's looking for is all the different personalities that are in the room. Who are the people that he needs to gain their trust and support very quickly, because they're the big influencers in the room. Who are the people that, you know, he needs to put an arm around? Who are the people that he actually needs to be aggressive with? And his belief was that management is all about observation of individuals, and getting each individual to the point where they can maximize their output. And it's really interesting, because he was talking about, for example, when he, and sorry, this is a little aside, but he was talking about when he was first managed the Japanese rugby union team.
Right.
And they'd never won an international game when he went there. And he said it was perfectly fine when he got there, because everybody just felt that, oh, well, they'll play the game and they'll lose. And nobody was really ever focusing on winning. And he turned the psychology around completely by saying, look, Japanese people can never compete with Westerners physically because of size. So we have to be like faster. We have to be smarter. We have to be more inventive in our style of play. And he talks about completely changing the mindset of the dressing room from just a bunch of guys who enjoyed rugby and enjoyed representing Japan, but had no expectation of doing anything at all in a game other than playing it, you know, not winning it, no expectation of that at all. In fact, the average loss when Eddie Jones went to Japan was 85 points per game in internationals for the Japanese. And he turned it around, and you know that they subsequently won games in the last two World Cups. That they've won games, if you remember.
Mm.
And I just wonder. I think they're different characters, Eddie Jones and Carlo. But I just wonder if Carlo hasn't sort of taken that sort of approach as well, where he's gone in and he's observed and he's worked out what he needs to do with almost every individual in the club. And then, you know, what he needs to do then collectively. Because I think personally, looking at, you know, we haven't had a podcast since, and we've played twice since last Sunday. I think looking at both performances, that there was a, you know, there's been quite a bit of criticism about how we've played, despite the results, despite the excitement of the results. And I actually think that was the way that we played was not by accident.
I agree. And I think the word criticism, not your use of it, but people criticizing is a little bit harsh, because, as you've said, Paul, he's looking at his squad, he's looking at the players he's got available at the moment, and we've got a few injuries at the moment. So he's using the squad to the best of his ability to get the result that he needs and that the club needs in order to pursue, you know, this charge up the table. I mean, 3 or 4 weeks ago, if people had said we'd be fourth, you know, certainly after the Fulham game, you'd have sectioned them. but he's, I think criticism of the way we've played is harsh. I mean, I put it in one of my match reports that it was far from, I think it was the West Brom game, far from a classic, but a workmanlike performance from Everton. And I think that's what Ancelotti is doing. If we get the chance to play expansive football, he'll do it. But if we need to keep things tight and sensible and within the players' abilities, that you know, within the players he's got available in each given situation, he plays to their abilities and their strengths rather than overstretching and running and taking risks, then it's difficult to argue when, you know, we've gone from those depths of despair against Fulham to 3 victories and not a goal conceded in those 3 games. You know, the defences look solid, Pickford's look solid, the midfield's worked hard, and all of a sudden the striker that people were beginning to have a few doubts about is banging form. And however he's doing it, however he is managing his resources right now, is working perfectly.
I think for once, the press conference that he did, the pre-match press conference for the Chelsea game, was actually quite interesting. And it was interesting for 2 reasons. First of all, he was asked about whether or not the team was his team. And this was his response.
I think he is my team. Everton is my team. Because, first of all, I am really happy to be the manager of this team, of these players, because I feel that these players follow me. They have a lot of respect of my idea. Of course, we would like to play better, but I am not the only one that would like to play better. Also, the players wants to play better, but in this sense, I think that we have to improve the technical quality of the squad. But what we cannot do is the spirit. What we can't improve is the spirit of this team that is really, really high. And I am really pleased to have this kind of quality in my team.
Now, it's clear from his response that, you know, he's enjoying himself at Everton. And it's clear, again, from what we just heard, that the players are actually enjoying playing for him. And I was fascinated by the fact that he used the word respect, that the players are doing what he's asking them to do, and he sees that as a great sign of respect.
I think it's charming that he's flattered.
Yeah.
That's a very good point, George. I hadn't thought about that, yeah.
You know, yeah, that's very mutual. It must be a very nice feeling between all of them.
Absolutely.
Some of the little cameos of when the players are lined up in the tunnel, especially at Goodison, and he walks through them and he just swaps gags with them. And you know, a little part of you goes, no, but we've got to beat these people, wind everybody up like that. And he's joking with the referee, and he is a one cool dude. he's going to stay that way. It's him, obviously.
Absolutely. The other interesting thing that he said in the press conference, and I don't have a recording of it, but was he talked about, and it's going back to your point actually, Andy, in terms of away form, why has our away form become so good this season? And he talked about essentially 3 elements to it: defence, great ability to counter attack, and really dangerous from set pieces. And if you think about it, that's almost exactly all that we do. So we set up defensively, you know, both actually, even in the Southampton game, we sort of set up defensively, but obviously in the West Brom game, we look very dangerous on the counter attack, especially playing Richarlison through the middle, which perhaps we need to talk about. And obviously we're I think we're now leading scorers from set pieces in the Premier League. Or if we're not, we're equal with West Ham, interestingly. I think we scored 14, isn't it, from set pieces. And that's the game plan. It's no more complicated than that. So you set up your defence. You have a midfield that helps out in defence, and you attack quickly on the break when you get the opportunity.
Yep.
It's very simple. Yep. And it's also probably why Richarlison has become so much more effective in recent games, because those tactics are ideally suited to him. I think they're less suited to DCL, who, you know, when he's running down on goal himself, like, for example, in the West Brom game, he doesn't necessarily look like he's always going to score. And in fact, he scores very few in those circumstances. Whereas that's exactly what Richarlison wants to do, isn't it? He wants to run at the goal with the ball. And he's fantastic at it.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can't remember the last game we played where we won the possession stats. Not that that matters, but it does give you a sort of statistical view on what you're saying about the way he's setting us up. And it's not pretty to watch, neither the Southampton match or the West Brom match. I got sent a thing this morning going, edited highlights, extended highlights of the Everton-West Brom match. I thought, blimey. Extended from what? Exactly.
It's in slow motion, George.
Yeah. Gilfie traps the ball, and yeah.
But it really doesn't matter, does it?
No.
I understand why people are going, I don't like the way we're playing, but the number of times since Moyes left, and, you know, when he was there as well, where we've come to matches where you know that everybody's going, win this and we're fourth, win this and we go above Spurs, win this, and we don't. Well, we do now. And if it's ugly, I don't care for the moment. I believe this man will sort it out, so we're playing some kind of Togger that we all want to watch. At the moment, I'm very happy to watch it because I'm an Everton fan and we're winning. And, you know, what you learn from watching matches like those two is winning is better than losing.
Of course it is.
Football without aesthetics gets a bit dull after a bit. But, you know, we have got aesthetic players. We have got players who can do things. And the more confidence that goes through the team, and we'll certainly be confident we come away from the bridge with a point, the better it can only be better.
We're seeing moments of brilliance, though, which is, you know, not something that we've seen very frequently at Everton, that sort of overcome what you describe as dullness, George. I mean, if you think about some of the goals that we've scored in recent weeks, there have been moments of absolute brilliance in them. You know, Anfield.
Sigurdsson's best passes of the last month, and it would be sumptuous.
Yeah.
They've been absolute. The one he put Richarlison through for against Southampton was fantastic. Just beautiful. And as good as Rodriguez's pass that put him in to score against Liverpool.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not as if we've been ugly consistently. There's been moments I think Carlo actually said that in one of his interviews, that the way that we're playing, so this reliance on counter-attacking, the reliance on set pieces to score goals, is because he's got confidence in the ability of the players, that he knows that we're going to produce a moment of quality at some point in the game.
Yes.
And that he's confident that perhaps just one moment of brilliance, maybe two occasionally, is going to be enough to win a lot of games.
Yeah, the key is, of course, when we make those two or three chances a game, that we take at least one or two of them. And at the moment, that's what he's managing.
Absolutely. So the critical moments, and I've heard a few people say, well, you know, we've been lucky in recent weeks. Well, after years and years and years of being unlucky, when other yeah. teams have done what to us, what we've been doing to other teams recently. Mm. I have to believe that it's not just down to luck. I think I'm a great believer in you make your own luck in life anyway, but I think it's down to the preparation, and it's that those you know, little moments of fine margins that, like anything in life, differentiate winners and losers.
Mm. Yeah,
yeah.
It doesn't matter what you do for a living or you know whatever. There's always a moment whereby you can either win something or you can lose something, and it's how you react. Obviously, you have to get yourself to that position, but it's how you react at that time that determines whether, having got to that position, you actually win or you lose. And I think under Carlo, he's teaching, some of them have already got it. I mean, obviously, he's bringing players into the squad, players like James and players like Alan, who have won stuff and know how to win stuff. Phil Neville was the same when he came to Everton. He'd won stuff. He knew how to do it. And obviously we didn't quite get to that point of winning something under Phil Neville's captaincy. But he brought something to the dressing room that we didn't have. Yeah. And I get the feeling that, without repeating myself, that what we're seeing now is not down to luck. It's not down to chance. This is cold, hard calculations. It's taking what we've got available to us. And, you know, we have a limited squad in terms of numbers, and not every player that plays for us is good enough possibly to be in a top six side.
He's maximising the effect that they can produce, isn't he?
Absolutely. You
know, he's probably squeezing a bit more from the players than we're expecting. But you know, while he's getting a tune out of these players, you know, if we can finish in that top four, and or win the FA Cup as well, I mean, that would be a staggering achievement. It really, either or both would be a staggering achievement, and would bring massive gains in terms of, you know, future recruitment, which would then give him the ability to play that little bit more expansively next season.
That's the carrot and the stick, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
If he was able to do that, I think that would be second in terms of achievement only to Leicester winning the Premier League in the modern football era.
Mm.
Given where we finished last season and how we finished last season,
more importantly.
Yeah. Obviously in difficult circumstances, given how we had to play, you know, 9 games in a very short period of time. But to take it from that and then have a very small, close season, to start the season really well as we did, and then obviously we had a run of losses, and we've had a couple of bad results at the beginning of this year. But since then, you know, we're unrecognisable, I think, as a football team compared to how we were, obviously 15 months ago, but possibly even just 12 months ago as well.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I don't think we should be surprised by what we're achieving, given who we've got, and given his apparent, well, it's not apparent, it's there, his commitment. I think he's wholly committed to achieving success at Everton.
So, Tim,
I think, you know, when you look at who he's coached in the past, where he's been manager, you know, Chelsea and Bayern and PSG and Real Madrid, and he kind of inherited strong, capable squads and then took them on. But when he came to Everton, he inherited, dare I say, a bit of a hodgepodge, and he's turning that around. This is, you know, Carlo Ancelotti at Everton, people, you know, what did, I mean, sections of the media said, you know, don't be ridiculous, Everton, you can't get a manager like Carlo Ancelotti. And yet we did. However we achieved that is immaterial. The fact is, he is our manager and he is turning things around. And I think he sees this possibly as, I don't know, maybe I'm getting a bit romantic here, but as his biggest challenge. Because when you inherit a Real Madrid or a Bayern Munich or a PSG in France, you're almost nailed on to win something every season. When he comes to Everton Football Club, with the state we were in at the time and the state we've been in for the last 4 or 5 years under successively poor managers, you know, he had a mountain to climb taking over Everton. Well, we're in the foothills now. You know, he's laid out base camp. You know, base camp is established. Now, he's moving up the slopes. He wants to reach a summit, and reaching a summit of winning a trophy with Everton, I think he would see that at least on a par, if not a greater achievement, than winning trophies at Chelsea, PSG, Bayern and Real Madrid. Because nobody else expected him to win trophies with Everton. And if he does it, you know, I mean, he'll go down in history, obviously. But I think he gets the urgency that we want the club to succeed in, and the passion that the fans have got for the club. I mean, you know, we said it yesterday when we were chatting. You know, Bawley said it. Once Everton has touched you, you know, and I think Everton has touched Carlo Ancelotti. And I think he is 100%, absolutely 100%, totally committed to returning Everton to trophy winning status and Champions League glory and everything that comes with it.
Fine speech, Andy.
Thank you, Arkid.
It was.
No, you're absolutely right, Andy. Yeah, absolutely right. I think, yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah.
I'll chuck some cold water in. Really worried about tomorrow night. Really worried that we won't see the ball very much. But as you've both said, and as Ancelotti himself has said, the team know perfectly well how they're going to play tomorrow night. They know what shape the game will be. It's just a question of, you know, fundamentally, can we keep a clean sheet? And anything beyond that is all pies in the bank, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he's not going to. We'll go to Chelsea tomorrow. You know, they haven't lost since Tuchel's come in. They've only conceded 2 goals since Tuchel's come in. Ancelotti won't want a repeat of last year's performance and result at Stamford Bridge. He'll probably look at Chelsea and think, you know, can we go toe to toe with them? No, probably not. So he'll work out. He'll be working on a game plan to stifle Chelsea, frustrate Chelsea, and as we've said, you know, in the last few games, you know, play on the counter attack, soak up as much of the Chelsea pressure as we can, and then make the most of one or two or three opportunities that we create, because we will create one or two opportunities. You know, the key is taking one of them. As have Fulham at Anfield, I have to tell you.
What? Really?
It's 1-0 Fulham.
Declare.
I read.
It's 1-0 at half time.
I read that, given that Wigan won at home yesterday, Liverpool have the worst home record this year, so 2021, in the whole of the Football League, 92 clubs. Isn't that glorious?
Stop it.
Well, they've got the next manager sorted out. He just won the Scottish Championship.
Let's not go there. Let's not go there. This is an Everton podcast. Let's not talk about that.
Oh, I don't know, Andy. Right, go on. Let's not talk about that. But let's talk about if we're still talking at full time and Fulham have won.
Fair enough.
But just going back to Chelsea, I mean, I hear what you say, George, based on their form under Tuchel has obviously improved significantly. But they don't score a lot of goals. You have to think, as you say, that we're going to get at least one decent chance through the game, hopefully more than that. And the other really interesting thing is that we're the best club in the Premier League for converting chances. So obviously we don't make as many chances as some other clubs, but actually our conversion rate, chance to goal, is better than anybody else in the Premier League. So if we do get that chance, or we get one or two chances tomorrow, that must be a high probability that we're going to score.
I don't know. Who would have suggested that he would have gone out against Liverpool at Anfield and wade into them? Everybody, including me, is expecting him to do what he's done away from home all season, which is sit back, soak it up, hit him on the break, play Leicester-type football that year they won the Championship. Mm-hmm. But there's every possibility because, that he might go, that's exactly what they're expecting us to do. We're not going to do that. We're going to go out and just go at them. Who knows?
Well, that could be entertaining.
I mean, the other thing about Ancelotti is he's made the hour before the kickoff utterly fascinating as you go, I wonder who he's going to pick this week. And, he's got shrinking options all the time. He's got less and less players to pick from, but he keeps shuffling the pack fantastically well.
Yeah. And it's very true. But then it's the in-game management that's really interesting as well. The games have become interesting just to try and spot what his thinking is and the changes that he makes throughout a game, either to bolster defence or to bolster our attacking options. I thought it was fascinating in the West Brom game that Sigurdsson comes onto the pitch. And it's Ancelotti who stops Dean from taking the free kick, the corner, because he wanted an in-swinging corner because he clearly feels that in-swinging corners are more dangerous than out-swinging corners. So the corner from the left-hand side to be taken by a right-footed player.
Yeah. Luca Dean wasn't best pleased about that decision until about 20 seconds later when he was celebrating the goal.
Yeah, but it was clear, the instruction came from the side of the pitch.
Yes, it did. He'd obviously spotted it. He'd obviously, it's in his head. He's obviously studied West Brom prior to the game and looked at their frailties defensively.
Well, again, he said that they'd worked on that on the sequence that led up to the goal. So, the in-swinging corner right into the 6-yard box. Okay, it didn't result in a goal straight away. The ball came back out to Sigurdsson, who just put in a wonderful cross. I mean, that was a cross that was begging to have an attacker on the end of. And
absolutely.
Richarlison's eyes must have lit up when he saw the ball coming to him. but the idea that, he's cool, calm and collected and he's standing there, drinking a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, yet at the same time, he can identify a particular moment in the game. And
it's experience, isn't it?
Yeah, because he's identified it, that's what it changes the game from what would have been a 0-0 to a 1-0. And that must give him a huge amount of satisfaction.
And all of us as well.
Yeah. But also the players as well. It must make the players trust his judgment.
Yeah. That's a very fair comment, because they could have been forgiven for thinking to themselves, you know, how are we going to break this lot down? And then all of a sudden, like you say, one decision and a failed cross and then a peach of a cross, and everything's swimming, everything in the garden's rosy again. And like you say, that meat injection that the players must feel, you know, when they've seen the manager say, no, Gilfie's taking it, and it works inside 10 seconds, you know, it's must be a tremendous boost to their confidence that, crap, this guy really knows what he's doing.
Yeah. And also, I mean, we've been talking about being defensive. Let's not forget that he's been very happy to play two people up front in DCL and Richarlison.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he made the conscious decision and told Richarlison to play more centrally and not to be too concerned about his defensive duties. And he said, you know, that took a little bit out of DCL's game, but that's fine because, you know, first of all, it's a team game, and secondly we won.
But it also meant that whilst he's taken that defensive responsibility off Richarlison temporarily, you saw it in DCL. DCL, I think, headed more corners away and free kicks away against West Brom than Richarlison did. And in recent weeks, Richarlison's been heading balls clear. So as he's taken the reins off Richarlison up front, giving him a bit more freedom up front, at, dare we say, you know, the detriment of DCL and his goal scoring, DCL's replaced him replaced Richarlison in the defensive aspect of his game. So it's becoming a much more team orientated performance all the time, you know.
I think there's probably also a recognition that Richarlison's probably in better goal scoring form than DCL at this moment in time.
He probably recognised the fact that Richarlison was desperate to get back on the goal scoring team. And I don't know, maybe no, I wouldn't say he's been holding him back, but the way we've played up to the derby maybe hasn't best suited Richarlison, and so he's released him from those shackles, if you like, and Richarlison, to be fair to him, is repaying him.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. It's indeed. All good news, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I'm going to stick my neck out. I think we're going to come away with a win tomorrow night.
Good for you, Paul.
And I think it'll really shake a lot of people up. I mean, I think I don't listen to the pundits because I don't think they add much value. But
that's true.
From what I've read, you know, they don't really see Everton as a serious challenge to the top four. They don't see West Ham as a serious challenge to the top four. And I suspect our challenge is greater than West Ham's. But the fact is that it is in our hands.
Absolutely. We've got that game in hand on everybody.
Yeah. And as Carlo said, we've got 12 games, 12 league games left. And it's down to us now. We're not reliant on another. We're no longer reliant on another team losing form,
no,
or dropping out of the top four. If we just carry on. It sounds silly, but it's the case. We keep on winning games, then we're going to be in the Champions League, and it might not just be fourth place. It might be third place.
Ooh,
oxygen,
and then we've still got the possibility of the FA Cup.
Yeah.
I mean...
Right, let's talk about that, because I'm interested in this. What are we supposed to do when we play City next time? What will be the difference between that match and the league match where, in the end, for my money, they comfortably beat us? They've beaten us 3-1 quite regularly at Goodison for ages. What's going to be different? What does he do? What do we do?
Heck of a question.
Well, he can't do what he did before, can he? You can't go, all right, City, you can play in front of us because they'll open you up and score.
Mm.
They've done it 21 games in a row. So he has to come up with something different. I don't know what. But I would suggest that, you know, because it is kind of, all or nothing, there's nothing for playing well and coming second in a cup match.
No.
That you might as well go and attack them. We didn't attack them. We didn't actually give City a game on our own pitch. Not really. We stood there and hoped, and like it always happens against them, they'll get you on the hour. And they did.
I agree totally, George. I think we have to be, we have to come out the blocks.
Yeah.
We have to come out the blocks very fast, and we have to be very aggressive, very assertive, put them under pressure, and knock them out of their stride.
Yeah,
I think so.
You know, say to them, if you want to win this game, it doesn't matter whether you've won the previous however many games it will be by that time, but you're not going to win this game easily.
No.
You are going to have to play at your very
best. Make them earn it.
You're going to have to play at your very best because we are going to be hammer and tong at you from the very start. And to answer your very good question, I think that's the only way that we can do it. I think, you know, seeing the game out and hoping the reverse of what we were talking about in terms of what we've been doing in the Premier League.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But what's great about Ancelotti is he likes to play differently.
Yes. Yeah. I just think we have to go for it. And, you know, if we end up losing 4-0, well, it's no different losing 4-0 than in a cup game than it is losing 1-0. I mean, you're out.
No, that's absolutely right. Yeah, go for it. It like you said, right from the first whistle, carry the game to City. If they, you know, we know that they're the best side in the division, but it's a one-off game. And we
must come off the pitch in the City game with we might regret the result, but having no regrets in terms of the way that we played.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
Like everything, we leave everything on the pitch, and nobody says afterwards, "Wow, we had a really good spell for 30 minutes in the second half when we looked like, you know, we might score," or the last 15 minutes when we threw everything at them. I'm not suggesting that we start with three up front, but when we threw Joshua King on and we had three up front, or Ben, you know, we moved Ben Godfrey forward, whatever the situation might be. I don't want us to think that, oh, if only we'd done that from the beginning of the second half, or if only we'd done that from the beginning of the game.
Well, it's like our kid always says, you know, if we play and lose, you know, fair enough. If we've given everything and we're beaten by a better side on the day, we have to accept it. But if we go out with a whimper, that would be disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is going to actually be the real test of how far we've come in recent weeks.
Indeed it will.
You know, if you cast your mind back to the, I was going to say Rumbelows Cup then, the Carabao Cup. That's a blast from the past. If you cast your mind back to the Manchester United game when we went out with a whimper, and I still get annoyed thinking about it now, because we didn't compete from at any point in the game. And I think against City, you go on the pitch and it's 11 against 11, and you compete from the first moment. And as I say, knock them out of their stride.
Sounds good to me.
Sounds
like a plan.
Give Pep the problem, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's overdue a problem, that boy.
Yeah, you consider yourself to be the best manager. You consider yourself to have the best football team in the Premier League, if not in Europe, if not club team in the world. Well, here's some problems you haven't thought of. Get yourself out of this one. And that's... in any sort of, I'm not saying it's David versus Goliath, because the difference between the two teams is not that great, but in any situation like that, that's what the perceived weaker party has to do. Yes, they, you know, that's the only thing you can do if to have any chance of winning. And if you say, oh, well, the probability of winning doing that is fairly slight, the probability of winning by not doing that is even slighter.
Yeah. It'll be, I think it'd be interesting. I think it could be one of the matches of the season, that one, because we're going to have to play.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of sneak it in the last minute, having defended all night, is, well, it'd be fabulous if they did it. But I'd rather than.
It's probably nobody else has managed to sit back and soak up City and hit them late on. It'd be folly. Or could that be the master plan?
If we win, that was the master plan. Can I ask a question? Because I believe you guys would pay more attention to this. What is Arsene Wenger's latest contribution to the future of football?
Ah, this is interesting. he's got a few going at the moment, our kid.
In what capacity, Andy?
Well, I mean,
he's got a job.
Pardon?
Has he got a job?
Yeah. Yeah. Wenger is working for FIFA.
Right.
And he's making recommendations on rule changes to the International Football Association board, this IFAB, who oversee the rule changes. And I mean, there's five or six at the minute. There's a proposed change to the handball rule. Well, it's not proposed. It will be changed from July the 1st.
Across the world.
Well,
yes, because IFAB
works for FIFA, doesn't it? It's part of FIFA.
Yeah, IFAB is like the global rule setter. So, if you want to play association football, you follow the rules of IFAB.
Yeah, and the main, and I mean, I'm reading this word for word here. The main change to the law, which will come into effect on July the 1st, is the accidental handball that leads to a teammate scoring a goal or having a goal-scoring opportunity will no longer be considered an offence.
The difference being that under the current rules, it is an offence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so...
Yeah. So you still can't score through accidental handball, but play won't be stopped in the penalty box for accidental handball. Right. That's effect. I think that's effectively what they're saying, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, referees will still have to use some judgment in looking at handball or the position of players' arms, and in relation to movement in the specific situations. But when it's, I mean, like the glaring, there was one this week in the Fulham Spurs game. Which was nonsense. Fulham scored and had it ruled out because the ball had hit a Fulham player's arm. But that was exactly the point. The ball had hit his arm. He hadn't moved his arm to try and gain any advantage with the ball. But under the current rules, the Fulham goal got ruled out and Spurs went on to win. Under this rule change, that goal would now stand.
Oh, right. And that's that, is it?
I'm not sure whether that one is directly down to Arsene Wenger, but certainly the proposed change to the offside rule is down to Arsene Wenger.
Tell us about this one, Andy.
Right, well, okay, I'm just scrolling down to it now. So here we go. So... FIFA President Gianni Infantino has confirmed that IFAB will be looking to conduct trials of a new interpretation of the offside rule proposed by former Arsenal boss Arsene Wenger. And basically, whereas at the moment, a player can be offside by his toenail being beyond the last defender, Wenger is turning it around so that if the forward's toenail is onside and the rest of him is, in inverted commas, offside, then he's onside. Any part of the body that's in line with the last defender makes the guy onside, as against now, where, you know, as we've seen, a millimetre.
So we would have ended up 1-1 with West Brom.
Yes, we would. Yes.
Right.
So that definitely favours the attacking side over the defender's side. And you know, whereas at the minute, it's the offside rule is weighted in the defender's way. You know, this is going to make things more interesting. It should produce more goal scoring opportunities, and dare I suggest it will produce more goals. Which is that such a bad thing in football?
No, that's good.
So it's effectively the clear daylight rule, isn't it? Where
yes,
if you're only offside if there's clear daylight between the attacker. Correct. And any member of the defence. Actually, no, it's not every. It's the second last defender, isn't it? Technically.
Well, yeah.
Second last opponent, because it includes the goalkeeper. Yeah.
Yeah, it includes the keeper, but like Arkid said, it would have meant that the late equaliser that West Brom had ruled out for offside would have stood under this new rule. That's going to be trialled. This hasn't been universally accepted yet, but it's going to be. They're going to trial it somewhere.
They're going to trial it in China, unbelievably.
Right. Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. In one of the junior leagues in China.
Right. But he's also Wenger's also come up with some other interesting proposals as well.
Go ahead.
On throw-ins. He's proposing that teams should be able to kick the ball back into play instead of throwing it back in if they're in their own half. I'm not quite sure what the benefit of that is, but that's one of his proposals.
Isn't that just going to slow the game down even more?
I'm not sure. I'm trying to figure that in my own mind, what exactly he's trying to achieve by having kick-ins in your own half as against throw-ins. Or why throw-ins are only restricted to the attacking half of the field. I'm not quite sure what he's aiming for there. But this one would be interesting. On corners, Wenger's proposing that if we go back to our goal at West Brom, Carlo changed the corner kicker from Luca Dinia, who would have been an outswinger, to Gylfi Sigurdsson, that was an in-swinger. Well, Wenger is now proposing that the out-swinging corner, if you like, the Luka Dean corner from the left-hand side, if it curves out of play and then back in, that it should be permitted.
I've always wanted this rule. It's the same rule as in rugby union, that the ball... If as long as it doesn't bounce out of play, remains in play.
Yeah. So that's his second radical change, that an outswinging corner that curves out of play and then back into play should be permitted. And then his third one is on free kicks, where he's suggesting that players should be able to touch the ball to themselves to restart play, and not be forced to pass to a teammate. So I guess he's thinking of an indirect free kick outside the box, rather than two players both needing a touch, that, if you like, Rodriguez could play it to himself before he takes the shot.
That's a really interesting one.
Yeah. He's a thoughtful bloke, isn't he?
Yeah, it also means that the player can effectively dribble from a free kick if he wanted to do so, and because you've got the 10-yard rule, the opponent can't be within 10 yards of you. That gives a massive advantage to the free kick taker.
Yeah.
Also, it would encourage everybody to play a lot quicker.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it goes back to in a sense, my idea that if you win a free kick, you can take it anywhere, you know, from wherever the ball lies, as long as it's not, the ball's not forward of where the free kick was taken, or where the offence was taken.
Yeah,
yeah,
and it gives the team who've offended that those few less seconds to be prepared. I mean, the idea of having a free kick is not to allow the defending team to get completely set up.
Well, this is exactly why there are so many free kicks when you're on the counter attack, isn't it?
Mm.
The defending side will always try and if they can't win the ball back, they'll always try and commit a foul in order to be able to set themselves up to defend the set play.
Yeah, to get back behind the ball.
Yeah, which, you know, seems like they're winning. Well, they are. They're winning a direct benefit from breaking the rules.
Yeah.
So anything that can balance that must be a good idea.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it brings in the discussion as to whether any professional foul like that should be, I mean, most do receive a yellow card, but whether it should be nailed on automatic. You know, a professional foul like that to slow down the opposition like that, should it be an automatic booking?
I think so, because it's the thing that annoys me most about football. Because
it's not professionalism, it's gamesmanship, isn't it?
It's the old ungentlemanly conduct. From my perspective.
Our kid's laughing at the idea of gentlemanly conduct in football.
It certainly is. I'm also still wondering about whether we can get Eddie Jones to coach the England cricket team.
Well, funnily enough, Eddie Jones, because he's half Australian.
Yep.
He talks about Steve Waugh.
Yeah.
He talks about how Steve Waugh, when he first started playing Test cricket, had every shot in the book, fantastic to watch, played everything, you know, offside, onside, front of the wicket, behind the wicket, really, really fabulous player. But he was only averaging sort of, you know, mid-30s. And Steve Waugh got dropped, and Steve Waugh went back to, grade cricket, club cricket in Australia. And Steve Waugh decided that he was going to remove all of the shots gave him a chance of getting out, and that his total focus from that point forward would be never to give his wicket away with a shot that he didn't have to play. Really interesting. And as a result of that, his average went from like mid-30s to what he ended up in the 50s by the time that he retired in Test cricket. And it was just this idea.
And obviously...
No, it was just this idea.
It made him one of the great Test captains of all time.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think we said on one of the WhatsApp groups, didn't we, during the week? And obviously we shouldn't really be talking about cricket here, but how invaluable the wickets seem to each other, or how little value the wickets seem to have. The great players of the past, right? The philosophy was always you never give your wicket up.
Mm.
And yet, you know, the moment that there's a collapse, well, you may as well start packing your bags, because you know the game's over in a couple of hours.
Maybe that's what Carlo's got lined up for the City Cup tie. We're going to doctor the pitch.
Spinner's wicket.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we could make the pitch very dry, which affects their passing game.
Yeah.
You don't have to turn the sprinklers on every game.
Yeah, no, slow things down.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we used to do in hockey, we used to turn the ice plant off at the start of the third period so it became soft and slushy.
What if you were winning?
Well, if you were playing a team that was really, really quick, the easiest way to slow them down was to soften the ice. And as you turn the plant off and the ice begins to soften and it becomes slower, because fast ice is hard ice.
Yeah.
And soft ice is slow. So it wasn't unheard of occasionally for, well, maybe not the plant to be completely turned off, but it would certainly be turned down so that the ice would soften up.
This is mad.
It's true.
Hockey team drowns.
Well, we got rid of the horses. Oh, that was polo.
funny stuff. All right. We've been talking for over an hour, I think. Yeah, just over an hour.
What's the score in the Liverpool game, Andy?
62 minutes gone. It's still Liverpool 0, Fulham 1.
Sorry, it just made me laugh.
There is something else we need. There is something else that's been bandied around on social media a lot this week. And it's over our dear friend Gylfi Sigurdsson.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
And it's whether, and I'm sure, I mean, there are obviously different views on this, whether Sigurdsson is worthy or deserves or should be given a contract extension.
Is his contract up at the end of the year?
No, his contract is up in June 2022. He's got 12 months after the end of the season.
But if we don't renew, his contract, then midway through next season, he becomes a free agent and could negotiate himself away.
Yeah, and he has no value to the club.
Yeah,
in terms of transfer value, if we wanted to move him on.
So to protect that transfer value, giving him a further contract extension would be a sensible idea.
Yeah. So I think first of all, you have to look at it from a footballing point of view. Is he worthy of a continued slot in the squad beyond next season? And I think you have to say on the evidence of his most recent performances, if he can maintain that for much of next season, then yes, he is. Or rather, much of this season, because the contract would be extended probably in the summer. The answer to that must be yes.
I think there's no doubting that the guy has got the tools in his locker. I think the doubt that many Evertonians might have on Gylfi Sigurdsson is that we don't see them as regularly as we'd like to. I mean, set aside the last month when he's been playing really, really well, and as we said before, you know, some of his passing. I mean, the two passes against Spurs in the cup and his pass against Southampton for the goal. Some of his range of passing is just brilliant. But it's how often we see it and how often he has that massive effect on a game. I think that's the grey area with him. There's no doubt in his talent and his skill. It's how often it actually appears.
I read that you have to keep him. The best form we've seen from him has been under Ancelotti. Ancelotti's going nowhere. Ergo Sigurdsson, whose game is not based on speed at all. Mm-hmm. So he's not as if he's going to slow up in the next couple of years to a point where he can't function, because he never skins anybody for speed, and I don't expect him to anymore. His game is based on how quick his feet are.
Yeah.
I can't see that you wouldn't... yeah, you I can't see that you wouldn't keep him. In the end, he's quality, and we need quality in every position. So the idea of getting rid of him would be bonkers to me.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
That's not to say, as you're hinting, Andy, that, you know, you shouldn't be on his case going, more, please, more.
I think that's where I am. I don't disagree with anything you've said about him, Arcade. I just would like to see it that little bit more each game, a bit more regularly. Because it would make people fear him. Not physically, not physically, obviously, but knowing that there's this guy who appears to float through games, who is capable of completely destroying you in the space of 2 or 3 minutes with 2 or 3 passes or a sublime turn and shot like that goal he scored at Fulham. Not Fulham, I've got Fulham on my brain. At Leicester, the season before last. You know, I just want to see more of those highlight moments from him, because he's undoubtedly got it. Just please, a bit more regularly, Gilfy.
There's always been a question mark throughout his career about his mental strength. You know, he was a much more effective player, for example, at Swansea than he was at Tottenham.
Yeah. Bigger fish in a smaller pond.
Yeah. And, you know, for much of his time at Everton, he's been, you know, largely ineffective, odd moments of brilliance, but, you know, sort of, not on a frequent basis at all, and not reliable. You never knew which Gylfi Sigurdsson was going to turn up, and it wasn't the good one, it was normally the bad one, and then occasionally the good one would appear for a short period. Mm. Perhaps, you know, and going back to what we said at the beginning of the podcast, perhaps he feels in a better place now because of Carlo.
Yeah, because of the manager, yeah.
And, you know, you could imagine Carlo being the type of guy that would, like, put his arm around him and, you know, tell him he was the best player that Iceland have ever produced, or whatever it was that he needed to get him moving in the right direction mentally. Because I do think that's a big part of why he hasn't been a success. Personally, I think he's the type of person that needs to be sort of loved a bit and cared for a bit.
Yeah.
And made to feel just a little bit special.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Which on his day, he is.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
He's got and this is the point, he's got the ability actually to be special. It just doesn't show it often enough. But if you can persuade somebody that you are special, and then play in a manner which allows you to accentuate what makes you special, then you're going to be more effective. And that's effectively what's happening now. You know, if you think about it, Sigurdsson is ideally has the ideal talents for a game that's built on counter-attack, so that, you know, he can play that through ball, as witnessed in recent weeks, or dead ball delivery. Now, I know he's never scored a free kick for Everton, but I'd like to know I don't know what the stats are, but I'd like to know how many goals have resulted from a free kick or from a corner that he's taken. It must be a substantial number, I would think.
Yeah.
His free kick's coming Monday.
Well, if you could...
I have every faith in the boy.
if you could produce the same free kick, albeit with his right foot, that Bainesy scored in that FA Cup game at Chelsea.
Oh, yes.
In the last minute, that would go down rather well. The fact,
oh, would it ever?
Disappointing that nobody would be there to see it, but hey, you know, we could live with that.
Yeah, totally. Looking at it from a bit more of a serious angle, though, Paul. I mean, this is your forte, and our kid is the word you've been wanting to hear all podcast. Amortization.
Oh no.
Where would Sigurdsson getting a contract extension affect the club with regards to valuations and transfer values and write-down values? as we said, how would that affect his amortization position?
As we said, first of all, you've got to be good footballing reasons for him to give him an extension. But secondly, there's actually good financial reasons for doing so as well.
Because you're not selling for what you paid, are you?
No. And we would have to sell him this summer in order to generate anything. Because in a year's time, he's going to have, well, he'll be out of contract, so he won't have a transfer value.
Yeah.
So there's that. Secondly, if we were to offer him a 12-month extension, it would reduce the amortization cost by about £4.5 million next year, which is going to be important to the club, although that's not a cash item, i.e. it's not cash that goes out the door. It's important because it affects the profit and loss account, and the profit and loss account is what is looked at from a financial fair play point of view. So if we offered him a 12-month extension to his contract, we'd actually save ourselves four and a half million, or our profit and loss figure would be £4.5 million better next year than it would be if we don't. So I would be amazed if we didn't offer him either a 1 or a 2 year extension.
Yeah. He's the kind of player who could be playing in 5 years' time.
Because he's not reliant on pace.
No, you know. He's just going to get smarter.
Yeah. The other point, I suppose, is also a replacement cost. If we did sell him, or if we allowed his contract to run down,
we've got to pay to replace him.
How much, even in a market where there's supposed to be good value for players, how much would you have to pay to actually replace somebody that had the potential to do what Sigurdsson potentially has?
At least what we paid for him, I would suggest.
Yeah.
You know, certainly in that ballpark.
And especially if we do make Champions League football, one of the strange impacts of Champions League football is that people charge you more to buy players.
Yeah.
Because you've got more money. Mm. So the replacement cost would be, I think, quite extraordinary. And frankly, we can use the money elsewhere.
Yeah,
we can use the money on a right back, you know, for example.
Use the money on replacing those positions that are not the same quality as him.
Yeah, yeah. Just there was one other thing actually, Andy. Whilst we were talking about Sigurdsson, I think it's worthy of mention, and that's our friend Jordan Pickford.
Right. Happy birthday, Jordan! By the way,
it's his birthday today.
Yeah.
Oh shit! I didn't send him a card.
Did you? Well, how remiss.
Well, you could have put your name on your card, Andy.
Oh, I said so from all at TTB.
Oh, excellent. That's good. Good man. His form has really turned round, yeah?
It has. Yes, noticeably. He looks a lot calmer in the last three games as against... You know, I mean, earlier through the season, you know, there's been people calling him a headless chicken and this, that, and the other, but he looks a lot calmer. And he, dare I say, I think he's thinking about his game a bit more. I mean, and why I'm saying that is there were people, well, pundits and what have you, making wry comments about that, the early save he made at West Brom, where he appeared to get off the ground a bit too early, and then had to adjust from saving it with his right arm to saving it with his left arm. But to me, I think that showed a bit of growing maturity. Yes, he probably did get off the ground a bit early, but he had the wherewithal to change his position in midair in order to make the save.
Yeah. Well, as Neville Southall said yesterday, you know, did they score? No. Did he save it? Yes.
Yeah.
Move on.
At the end of the day, it doesn't matter how he makes the save. The important bit is that he makes the save, and that's what Neville's referring to, isn't it?
Yeah. That his job is to... It's to stop the opposition from scoring, and he did that.
Yeah.
But again, I think it comes back to two things. His form comes back to having Olsen in the side, and Carlo
pressure.
Carlo being willing to, you know, make the changes when necessary. And it probably comes down to Carlo's management as well. And, you know, Carlo says some really nice things about him.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you don't often hear people saying nice things about him. I don't know whether he's a nice guy or not, but...
But the other thing as well, Paul, is you said it the other week that you know, he's... The word is that Jordan Pickford has employed his own sports psychologist.
Yep.
And maybe now we're beginning to see the fruits of that. That whoever it is has been working with him and having some good effect. As I suggest, he's a bit calmer, a bit more composed. The rushes of blood, shall we say, are being taken out of his game. And if that is down to the work he's doing with a sports psychologist, all power to him. And if he instigated that himself, as against it being something that the club organised, if he thought to himself, I need some help, so I'm going to employ a sports psychologist, that shows a growing maturity in the boy as well.
Shows a desire to improve, which is exactly what you want.
Yeah, yeah.
And it also shows that he wants to play for the club, and he'd rather play than not Olsen play, which is, again, you know, the thought process that you always try and create.
I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't think that Michael Keane and Godfrey in front of him is the best pairing available.
Yeah. I mean, you've made a very valid point there, like it. I mean, we should recognise the impact that Ben Godfrey's had on the side in his first season. It's nothing short of astonishing. He gives us energy. He gives us solidity. I mean, his performances individually have been exceptional, but what he's done in solidifying that back line and forming a partnership with Keane in his first season is outstanding for me.
But he's the finished article, Andrew.
Yeah.
This guy's going to win,
doesn't he?
A whole pile of international caps. He looks like Bobby Moore. There's nothing to teach him. He understands everything. He's really, really, really tasty player. Whoever did the shopping on him gets a major, major pat on the back. The boy's total class.
Yeah.
You know, that little blonde boy for West Brom is the first person I've seen him who tricked him. Just once he turned him and got a cross in. And I sat there going, wow, you've done Ben Godfrey. Well done. I haven't seen anybody else do that.
Yeah.
Nobody. He's very, very special.
Yeah, all good news.
All right, so let's finish with some predictions. And then we've got a little musical treat at the end for our listeners.
Sorry, Paul, we might be running where we were 20 minutes ago. What's the score in the match, Andy?
I was going to say we might need to spin this out for another 10 minutes because it's 80 minutes on the clock and Fulham are still up 1-0.
predictions. Go on.
Chelsea on Monday night. Paul's already gone for a win. It's tricky, isn't it? It's tricky. But hey, listen, we're overdue a win at Stamford Bridge. Yeah, I'm going to go for it as well. I'm going to go 1-0. 1-0 Everton.
I'm much more cautious than that. I think they'll siege us. And if we sneak one, that'll be a treat. I'll go for a clean sheet, please, and I'll take whatever happens at the other end.
Fair enough.
Right, fair enough. All right, I'm going to go for 2-0, by the way.
Oh, 2-0.
Good for you, Paul.
Yeah. Probably a Sigurdsson penalty. And
No, we want a Sigurdsson free kick. Or is he getting both of them?
You might get both now, Andy. Yeah?
Fair enough. Good on you, Gilfie.
Get that contract signed.
Yeah.
All right. Listen. Yeah.
Speaking of contracts, any news yet on Mr. Brands?
No, but I don't believe there's any problems. So it's just, it'll happen when it happens, I guess.
Right, cool. Fair enough.
Yeah. Good stuff. All right, gents, thank you so much for your time. Thank you to all of those that have listened to us today. Hope you've enjoyed it. We certainly enjoyed producing the podcast, and I'm sure some of you at least enjoyed listening to us. So thank you all. Enjoy the game tomorrow. Stay safe, as Andy says. And, well, we'll be talking to you next week from an even stronger position than we are in this week.
Woohoo!
Enjoy the ending music, guys. Thanks very much. Bye.
With Everton win and Liverpool lose, oh Everton, you got me singing.